In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Questions about the accuracy of COVID-19 tests is the subject of a recent study by the University of Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine and the University of the West of England. They found the swab-based technique used for most COVID testing is at risk of returning false positives, since the copies of the virus's RNA detected by the tests might simply be dead, inactive material from a weeks-old infection. Patients infected with COVID-19 are typically infections for a week or less. Tests can be triggered by virus genetic material left over from a weeks-old infection. For example, earlier this summer, a Connecticut state lab found 90 false positives out of 144 coronavirus tests administered. Approximately 3,700 Swedes received false positive COVID-19 tests because of a faulty testing kit from China, according to Reuters, citing a Tuesday statement by Sweden's public health agency, and that read, "The kit was unable to distinguish between a very low level of the virus and a negative result." Add this to the reports of more than 96% of U.S. COVID-19 deaths having pre-existing conditions and or comorbidities. And then recently, a report came out showing more than 95% of UK COVID deaths had pre-existing conditions as well. Testing data is often released before corrections are made. You'll then read about a spike in COVID cases in certain areas. That's usually because tests were administered. This is probably important data that decisions to open economies, stop quarantines are based on. If mistakes are made and corrected, then adjustments in decision-making would naturally follow. But that doesn't seem to be what's happening, and people know it. Again, this pandemic is a catalyst to get you to slowly comply to a mass reset process. A story out of WZTV Nashville based on leaked emails between the senior advisor to Nashville's mayor and someone from the health department reveals intent to conceal very low coronavirus cases coming out of bars and restaurants, while the high numbers of cases occurred in nursing homes and construction workers. A city council member says he has been contacted by an endless stream of downtown bartenders, waitresses, and restaurant owners. Why would they not release these numbers? We raised taxes 34% and put thousands of people out of work that are now worried about losing their homes, their apartments, etc. And we did it on bogus data. That should be illegal. End quote. The very fabric of democracy is being challenged day to day, moment to moment. A listener, Tom, in California, sent in footage from recent Shasta County citizen comments to the county board regarding the draconian decision-making related COVID business closures and measures. Keep in mind that the data they're basing their decisions could be, and most likely is, full of errors. Let's have a listen.
Yeah, Carlos Zapata. I wasn't going to speak. I was asked to speak here, you know. Sheriff, good to see you. I'm telling you guys, you know, I'm pretty appalled at what's going on. You know, at first we sat as concerned citizens and we all wanted to figure out how to best navigate our way through this whole COVID thing, you know. And as we realized that it's not quite as dangerous as we thought it'd be, you know, I was absolutely appalled at the cowardice, you know. And as you're sitting there with your masks on, I don't blame you for wearing masks, because I'd be hiding my face too if I was you for what you're doing. This is absolutely horrendous what you're doing to these people. I'm a business owner, and I'm telling you, our families are starving. You know, you guys can sit here with your jobs, you can sit here and you're going to get paid, you can fall asleep in your chair like that gentleman's doing behind his mask right there, okay? And I'm telling you right now we're being peaceful. And you better be happy that we're good citizens, that we're peaceful citizens. But it's not going to be peaceful much longer, okay? And this isn't a threat. I'm not a criminal. I've never been a criminal. But I'm telling you that good citizens are going to turn into real concerned and revolutionary citizens real soon. And nobody else is going to say that. I'm probably the only person that has the balls to say what I'm saying right now. That we're building, we're organizing, and we'll work with law enforcement or without law enforcement. But you won't stop us when time comes because our families are starving. And if you don't hear the seriousness of my voice, I hope you open your ears and you absolutely listen to what I'm saying. Because this is a warning for what's coming. It's not going to be peaceful much longer. It's not going to be rah-rah. It's not going to be speeches. It's not going to be gathering outside saying a Pledge of Allegiance. It's not going to be waving flags. It's going to be real. When you've seen the things that I've seen, I went to war for this country. I've seen the ugliest, dirtiest part of humanity. I've been in combat, and I never want to go back again. But I'm telling you what, I will to save this country. If it has to be against our own citizens, it will happen. And there's a million people like me, and you won't stop us. Open the county. Let our citizens do what they need to do. Let owners of businesses do what they need to do to feed their families. Take the masks off. Quit masking and muzzling your children. The psychological damage you're doing to them is horrible. I've had 6 friends kill themselves since it's happened. Veterans who lost their jobs. How do you feel about being complicit in perpetuating that? The greatest hoax ever perpetuated on the American people. And you're a part of it by wearing your masks. In Shasta County, we're supposed to be red country up here. Not blue country, we're red country up here. You guys know that. You claim to be conservatives, maybe you're not. Maybe you're liberals, I don't know. But by God, we're Americans. And remember that. Take your masks off. Quit muzzling yourselves. Join us. Fight with us against what's going on in Sacramento. It's a travesty. Thanks.
My name's Tim Fairfield, and I live in Shingletown. I enlisted in Shasta County. I took the oath of enlistment before I could vote, an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I'd like to remind you, you took a very similar oath. A lot of you may have forgotten that. I would hope you just forgot you took that oath and you weren't just liars from the beginning. There are hundreds of people out there, and yet I stand in an empty room. This isn't your room. It belongs to those people out there. And I can't figure out if you're just hiding in here, you know, an empty room, you got your sycophants and maybe a few toadies. Are you hiding from the public out of contempt or just cowardice? Maybe corruption? I'm not sure. There's a lot of questions going on out there, and that's what they're asking. Let me remind you of what the law says in California from the Open Meetings Act. The people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. The people, in delegating their authority, do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments they have created. This is their body, not yours. This is 2020, so maybe I can take a page from your friends at Antifa and BLM. If you don't want the people in this room exercising their God-given authority to supervise you, their servants, we can take these protests to your house, to your neighborhoods. How long do we have to march in front of your streets before you're a pariah to your neighbors, before you're reviled in your community? That is an option. Peacefully to assemble doesn't mean that you get to hide in this room from the protest. You know, you were more than glad to let BLM take the streets 2 months ago. We can do that. So let me remind you of something else that one of our greatest founders had wrote. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. Where do you stand? And to those of you over there with that badge, you took an oath too. And so when these people do not let the citizenry of this county into this building to participate in their process, who's breaking the law and who do you side with? Thank you.
My name is Dodie Jones, and I don't know if you know, but yesterday there was a lawsuit that won in Pennsylvania, and it was presided by Judge William Stickman IV. He wrote in his ruling on the lawsuit filed by the many counties that the pandemic policies have been overreaching, arbitrary, and violated citizens' constitutional rights. The declaratory judgment says that the congregate gathering limits imposed by defendants' mitigation orders violate the rights of assembly enshrined in the First Amendment. Number two, that the stay-at-home and business closure components of the defendant's orders violated the due process clause of 14th Amendment. That the business closure components of defendant's orders violate the equal protection clause of the 14th Amendment. And in his written opinion, Stickman said the liberties protected by the Constitution are not fair weather freedoms, in place when times are good, but able to be cast aside in times of trouble, Stickman wrote. There is no question that this country has faced and will face emergencies of every sort, but the solution to a national crisis can never be permitted to supersede the commitment to individual liberty that stands as the foundation of the American experiment. The Constitution cannot accept the concept of a new normal where basic liberties of the people can be subordinated to open-ended emergency mitigation measures. Rather, the Constitution sets certain lines that may not be crossed, even in an emergency. Actions taken by defendants cross that line. It is the duty of the court to declare those actions unconstitutional. And when you close people's businesses, that's the same as stealing their property without due process. You are breaking so many laws, and you all took an oath to the Constitution. I think you should stand by it. Thank you.
Those were a sampling of citizens speaking at a Shasta County citizen comment period at the county board, sent in from a listener in the area. Thank you, Tom. Last week, the Corbett Report produced an important video titled COVID-9/11 Security State, showing how Homeland Security grew out from the attacks on September 11, 2001, and now the biosecurity industry is doing something similar in the wake of the COVID-19 era. Let's go now to hear some of that report.
9/11, as we were told repeatedly in the days, weeks, and months after the attack, was the day that changed everything.
In the span of one devastating morning, America changed forever.
Good morning. America may never be the same, and this is why.
American life will change forever as a result of this attack.
Nothing will ever be the same again.
Nothing will ever be quite the same again.
Life will never be quite the same.
These were no empty words. They were plain statements of fact. The world did change on that day. 9/11 was the carte blanche for a great reset, the institution of a new normal in international relations and domestic affairs. From the creation of the Department of Homeland Security and the militarization of the police, to the multi-trillion dollar wars of aggression to reshape the Middle East, our lives today are drastically different than they were before that fateful Tuesday in September 2001. But nearly two decades later, 9/11 has gone from a touchstone event shaping all of the Western world's national security decisions to a fading cultural memory of a trauma that took place before the newest generation of high school graduates were even born. 9/11 is no longer a driving political issue. But, as if on cue, a new event has come along to throw the world into chaos. Once again, we are being told that the world has changed forever.
This is not normal. At least it wasn't until a few weeks ago, when everything we take for granted, everything moved just beyond our grasp.
As a global community, we've experienced a once-in-a-lifetime event that will shift and reshape our behaviors and perceptions for quite some time.
This will be the new normal until a vaccine is developed.
Meaning the new normal could last for months, even years.
So a return to normal as we knew it is not on the cards in the near future.
And, once again, this is no empty rhetoric. Governments, businesses, and NGOs are now coordinating at the international level on a great reset to once again completely reshape the world we are living in.
History would look at this crisis as the great opportunity for reset.
The Great Reset is a welcome recognition that this human tragedy must be a wake-up call. It is imperative that we reimagine, rebuild, redesign, reinvigorate, and rebalance our world.
Reset cannot mean, we can't think of it in terms of sort of pushing a button and going back to the way things were. And the normal was a crisis. The normal was itself not working.
I think all Canadians understand that the restart of our economy needs to be green. It also needs to be equitable. It needs to be inclusive.
What we're going to have to figure out, and I think what we're all going to have to figure out together, is what our new normal looks like. Our new normal includes physical distancing from others. Our new normal includes wearing masks where appropriate. Our new normal includes us knowing where this virus is each and every day, where we live, where we work, where we want to travel.
In parts of Europe, immunity passports are being considered for people who are believed to be immune to the coronavirus. While in China, some cities have already implemented QR codes that generate a color in order for officials to enable how freely an individual may move around outdoors.
Those paying attention will have already noted the parallels between the war on terror declared after 9/11 and the war on the invisible enemy that has been declared on COVID-19. In fact, the security imperatives imposed by this pandemic crisis are so similar to those imposed by the terror crisis that, in many cases, the new security screening tools that are being put into place to combat COVID-19 are openly acknowledged to be mere upgrades of screening tools deployed after 9/11.
Most people know CLEAR by going to the airport. It was born after 9/11. This is another crisis with a new component that's being born. Explain what this product is in terms of how it's going to work relating to COVID.
So you're right. CLEAR was born out of 9/11, and it was about a public-private partnership leveraging innovation to enhance homeland security and delight customers. And that was really the beginning of screening 1.0. And just like screening was forever changed post 9/11, in a post-COVID environment, you're going to see screening and public safety significantly shift. But this time it's beyond airports, right? It's sports stadium, it's retail, as Dana talked about. It's office buildings, it's restaurants. And so while we started with travel, at our core, we're a biometric secure identity platform where it's always been about attaching your identity to your boarding pass, the airport, or your ticket to get into a sports stadium, or your credit card to buy a beer. And so now with the launch of CLEAR Health Pass, it's about attaching your identity to your COVID-related health insights for employers, for employees, for customers. Everybody wants to know that each other's safe to start to reopen businesses and get America moving. Right.
Yes, in some ways, the coronavirus security state is merely an extension of the 9/11 security state. But even more disturbing parallels between 9/11 and COVID-19 are to be found at a deeper level of analysis. It is true that, just like the response to the 9/11 attacks, the response to the COVID-19 crisis is being framed in terms of security. But whereas the post-9/11 era introduced America to the concept of homeland security, security from terrorists, individuals with identifiable intentions belonging to groups with stated political goals, the COVID-19 era is introducing the world to an altogether more abstract concept, biosecurity. Originally employed to describe threats to the environment, the introduction of invasive species to a habitat, for instance, or the transmission of infectious diseases among crops and livestock, the term biosecurity was injected into mainstream political discourse when the 2001 anthrax attacks linked bioterrorism to the global war on terror. Suddenly, biosecurity was a pressing national security threat, and an entire architecture of national and international legislation was introduced to institute procedures for implementing medical martial law. In the U.S., the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act was passed in multiple state legislatures, giving governors the power to forcibly quarantine and even force vaccinate their populations in the event of a declared public health emergency. On the international level, the World Health Organization adopted the International Health Regulations in 2005, obligating all 196 WHO member nations to recognize declared public health emergencies of international concern, like pandemic disease outbreaks, as a global threat requiring international cooperation. Some have even argued that the legislation is broad enough to allow organizations like NATO leeway to enter countries in the interest of controlling the outbreak. Once again, the tie between this biosecurity paradigm and the war on terror paradigm is openly acknowledged. In a 2002 paper on the emerging biosecurity field, two U.S. environmental researchers noted the way that 9/11 had opened the door for biosecurity research and legislation. The events of September 11th and subsequent anthrax assaults have made U.S. policymakers and the public more aware of our vulnerability to organisms released with the intent to cause significant harm, they wrote. In 2010, the World Health Organization issued its own information note on biosecurity, stating that the overarching goal of biosecurity is to prevent, control, and/or manage risks to life and health, and, echoing post-9/11 declarations about the need for global cooperation in the war on terror, that this goal can only be reached through a harmonized and integrated biosecurity approach based on international standards. What this predictably bland language obscures is the way that biosecurity is used to invoke emergency powers and install new security procedures. Just as the Homeland Security paradigm used the presumed threat of terrorism as an excuse to curtail civil liberties, so too does the biosecurity paradigm use presumed threats to public health as an excuse to curtail civil liberties.
In Hangzhou, to enter a tower block, you need to have your temperature taken and registered. And you must have an app on your phone into which you input your name, temperature, recent travel, and ID number. The information generates a color code.
In Hangzhou, to go out of the community or to public activities, you need to have a green code. This green, yellow, or red code is automatically decided through the system. It uses big data to decide whether you've been to affected districts or come into contact with those people.
Chinese police officers are also seen in another disturbing video, nailing in wooden planks to block the front door of an apartment with people inside who had just returned home from Wuhan. Afterwards, officials are seen sticking a red sign beside the front door which reads, "The people in this house have just returned from Wuhan. Don't be in contact with them." The poor people inside are heard desperately screaming, "Open the door!"
Melbourne is in full lockdown tonight as historic Stage 4 restrictions take effect, forcing entire industries and shopping precincts to close. Health officials say it's the only option to stop the second wave, and we'd be looking at 20,000 cases if we hadn't shut down.
Can you, like, report this? I'm in my pyjamas.
What's this?
I had an ultrasound in an hour before.
Yeah, she's pregnant, so...
Well, I'll take it easy.
What's this about?
But I have an ultrasound
just let me finish.
In an hour.
Let me finish and I'll explain. It's in relation to a Facebook post, in relation to a lockdown protest you put on for Saturday.
Yeah, and I wasn't breaking any laws by doing
you
that.
You are actually. You are breaking law. That's why I'm arresting you. In relation to...
How can you arrest her? That's...
Police are preparing to launch their aerial arsenal as part of a crackdown on COVID rule breakers. High-powered drones will be used to find people not wearing masks and cars too far from home.
Dragonfly's public health and safety system uses standard 4K cameras to provide anonymized data on social distancing, heart rate, respiratory rate, and fever detection.
My orders are sa police pati military. Pati mga barangay, shoot them dead.
Why are you surrounding my children? Please step away from my children.
Please step away from my children. Your children
are
fine.
Can we just go home?
I'm fine, right? But I've got cuffs that are too tight on my arms. All I was doing was shopping. I explained to you that I don't have to have a mask on for health reasons. And then three people come up to me, start twisting my arms up. For what?
What's on him?
Can you tell me why I'm under arrest? Why have I got cuffs on? Right, well, you can't just detain me under what law?
Well, at the moment, we don't have specific powers, but they will come very shortly, I'm sure. But in the British policing model, we always start by talking to people. We always start by advising people. We can talk even more firmly to people.
Who the f*** do you think you're grabbing? Hey, who are you grabbing? Who the f*** are you grabbing? Get off me! I've told you, no! Now get off me!
Or I'll get you locked up.
Now get off me! Now you've been told. Get the f***! Oi! Who the f*** are you grabbing there?
I'll spray you, mate.
What? You're not spraying me for nothing?
He hasn't done nothing wrong.
There's a significant police presence there. A number of these protesters chanting freedom. We can also see that crowd, just the size of that crowd and the number of police that have gathered. There's public order response, there's mounted police as well. Also, riot police have mobilised to try and manage this crowd.
The nightmarish police state that is coming into view on the back of this pandemic panic is not a temporary state of affairs, nor is it a haphazard set of measures thrown together on an ad hoc basis. It is the creation of a new form of governance. This new form of governance relies on the perceived sense of crisis, in this case, a public health crisis, to justify constant surveillance of the public and new powers to inhibit the travel of anyone deemed a health risk. Famed Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben has documented how this biosecurity state is being erected on the back of the panic that 9/11 and the war on terror helped induce in the public. We might say that once terrorism was exhausted as a justification for exceptional measures, the invention of an epidemic could offer the ideal pretext for broadening such measures beyond any limitation. The other factor, no less disquieting, is the state of fear, which in recent years has diffused into individual consciousness and which translates into a real need for states of collective panic, for which the epidemic once again offers the ideal pretext. Therefore, in a perverse vicious circle, the limitation of freedom imposed by governments is accepted in the name of a desire for safety, which has been created by the same governments who now intervene to satisfy it. The parallel nature of 9/11 and COVID-19 as catalyzing events ushering in states of collective panic and, ultimately, new forms of governance, is seen most clearly in the area where these two paradigms overlap: bioterrorism. The molten steel on the Ground Zero pile had not even cooled before the American public and the people of the world were confronted with the specter of bioterrorism. Beginning a week after 9/11 and continuing for weeks thereafter, a series of letters containing anthrax spores were mailed to media personalities and government officials in an apparent continuation of the terrorist attack on the U.S. The letters were quickly tied to both Al-Qaeda and Iraq in the mainstream media.
Peter, from three well-placed but separate sources tonight, ABC News has been told that initial tests on the anthrax sent to Senator Daschle have found a telltale chemical additive whose name means a lot to weapons experts. It is called bentonite.
It's possible other countries may be using it too, but it is a trademark of Saddam Hussein's biological weapons program.
It does mean for me that Iraq becomes the prime suspect as the source for the anthrax used in these letters.
The 24/7 coverage of the event in the media ceased abruptly, however, when it was discovered that the strain of anthrax used in the attacks sourced not to Iraq, but to the U.S. military's own bioweapons laboratory at Fort Detrick, Maryland. But this convergence of terrorism and biosecurity did not start with the anthrax attacks. It began in June of 2001, a full 3 months before 9/11 and the declaration of the War on Terror itself. That was when a number of ranking U.S. military and intelligence officials took part in Dark Winter, a high-level exercise that simulated the U.S.'s response to a smallpox attack on the homeland by bioterrorists. The drill, co-hosted by the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, took place at Andrews Air Force Base on the 22nd and 23rd of June 2001, and even involved fake news reports that were broadcast to the participants as the simulation unfolded.
On day six of the smallpox epidemic, the White House confirmed that federal government officials and military personnel are being vaccinated. 300 people have died. At least 2,000 are infected with smallpox. Still, no group claims responsibility for unleashing the deadly smallpox virus. But NCN has learned that Iraq may have provided the technology behind the attack to terrorist groups based in Afghanistan.
In an incredible parallel, the same Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security that co-hosted Dark Winter also co-hosted Event 201, a simulation of a globally spreading novel coronavirus pandemic that was held in New York just months before the declaration of the globally spreading novel coronavirus pandemic that hailed the advent of the era of biosecurity. This exercise similarly involved fake news broadcasts.
It began in healthy-looking pigs, months, perhaps years ago. A new coronavirus spread silently within herds. Gradually, farmers started getting sick. Infected people got a respiratory illness with symptoms ranging from mild flu-like signs to severe pneumonia. The sickest required intensive care. Many died.
Unsurprisingly, many of the same characters that were involved in the promotion of the bioterror scare under the old Homeland Security paradigm have been influential in promoting the COVID-19 scare under the new biosecurity paradigm. The phrase Homeland Security itself was popularized in Washington in the late 1990s and capitalized on by the Answer Institute, which formed an Institute for Homeland Security in 1999, led by Randall Larson, a professor and department chair at the National War College. The Institute prepared a course on Homeland Security, which was to be co-taught by Larson and his National War College colleague Robert Cadlick. Coincidentally, the course was slated to begin on September 11, 2001. Part of the course syllabus included a review of the Dark Winter exercise, which the Institute for Homeland Security co-created. The name Dark Winter derives from a statement made by Larson's colleague, Robert Cadlick, credited as a biowarfare defense expert during the exercise's fake news broadcast.
And the problem is we don't have enough vaccine to go around.
Meaning we don't have enough vaccine for the United States?
Well, I would like to think that, but we don't have sufficient stockpiles for the people in Oklahoma, Georgia, or Pennsylvania, much less for the entire United States population.
Well, that certainly doesn't sound encouraging. What do you mean exactly?
Angie, it means it could be a very dark winter for America.
Sobering. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Cadlick.
A career officer and physician in the United States Air Force, Cadlick would go on to contribute to the FBI's investigation of the 2001 anthrax attacks, and then serve in several key biosecurity-related roles in the George W. Bush White House. During this time, Cadlick helped draft the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act. Passed by Congress in 2006, the act greatly expanded federal power during public health emergencies and consolidated many of these powers in a new office, the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. Then, in what Cadlick has called just a coincidence, Trump appointed Cadlick himself to that position in 2017. In his role as ASPR, Cadlick oversaw a joint exercise in 2019 named Crimson Contagion. The drill included the National Security Council, the Pentagon, the Department of Homeland Security, and a raft of other government agencies, and simulated the U.S. government's response to a viral pandemic originating in China and spreading around the globe. Like Dark Winter, the Crimson Contagion exercise took place just months before the events it was simulating began to play out in real life. And, like Dark Winter, it gave participants like Cadlick the chance to argue that biosecurity was a pressing national security challenge that the country was ill-prepared to meet. An argument that he made to Congress with Dr. Anthony Fauci by his side just 1 week before the first reports of the novel coronavirus spreading in China.
Dr. Cadlick, what keeps you up at night when you think about preparedness for the next big flu outbreak?
Pardon me. Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate the question. I mean, I sleep like a baby. I wake up every 2 hours screaming. But
like me.
Yeah. But I think the key thing here is a pandemic. Quite frankly, I have the unique background on this committee or this dais to have served 2 years on the Senate Intelligence Committee and looked at the many threats that face the United States. But there is no singular threat that could devastate our country through our health and our economy and our social institutions than pandemic influenza.
Yeah.
And we had four during the last century. And even though we've had a mild one in this first century, I think the risk is that we'll have another severe one, and that would devastate our country.
Then there's Donald Rumsfeld. As Secretary of Defense in the first term of the George W. Bush administration, there are few people more closely associated with the War on Terror. Rumsfeld, too, has been intimately associated with the emerging biosecurity state for decades. In the 1980s, he personally participated in secret meetings with Saddam Hussein that resulted in anthrax, botulism, and other chemical weapons being sent from the U.S. to Iraq. In the 1990s, he was named chairman of Gilead Sciences, a California biotech company that profited handsomely from the scramble for Tamiflu during the bird flu scare of 2005, and which is currently profiting handsomely from Remdesivir as a result of the COVID-19 scare.
The data shows that Remdesivir has a clear-cut, significant, positive effect in diminishing the time to recovery.
That was part of the report titled COVID-9/11 Security State. In Canada, for what it's worth, a Canadian common law group created a national law to strike down all COVID-19 restrictions. This is from the Common Law Assembly. Common law is defined as a body of legal rules that have been made by judges as they issue rulings on cases, as opposed to rules and laws made by legislature or in official statutes. Let's have a listen.
Hello, this is Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. It's September 8th, 2020. I'm speaking to you from the territory under the jurisdiction of the Republic of Canada, formerly the Dominion of Canada. A message today of great hope to all Canadians and everyone around the world. A national law has been passed by our National Council of Common Law Assemblies that strikes down all COVID regulations. This is in the wake of similar local bylaws that have been passed over the last few weeks, but now this law extends across Canada. It not only strikes down the COVID regulations of distancing and masking and quarantine and vaccinations, it empowers local citizens to actively say no. And these laws will be distributed through our local common law assemblies and also at republicofcanada.ca. Let me first share with you this law. It was passed by the National Council of Common Law Assemblies, representing literally thousands of Canadians across the country. And it's a far more representative body than Parliament, which is closed down, the courts of law, which are not operating, or these individual bureaucrats in government, which are telling everyone what to do without any lawful authority. The law says, let it be known that the regulations in Canada that restrict free movement and association and impose mandatory quarantines, social distancing, mandatory testing, and vaccinations, and the wearing of masks are unlawful measures, as they've been decreed by no court of law or legislature, and they're medically unsound requirements that threaten and assault the fundamental liberties, health, and security of all Canadians, as well as violating the internationally recognized right of free and informed consent that govern all medical procedures according to the Nuremberg Statutes of 1947. Therefore, it is ordered by the National Council of Common Law Assemblies, as a voice and defender of the people of Canada, that A, no one is obligated to consent to or comply with any COVID regulations, regardless of who's ordering them, and B, anyone is free to actively resist those regulations to the best of their abilities without fear of any consequence, because they are acting within the law and their natural liberties to defend their person. Therefore, it is ordered by this Council of Common Law Assemblies that any agent of the state or corporations, any individual or member of these institutions that try to impose these measures on ordinary Canadians is guilty of a crime. In fact, they're engaged in a crime against humanity and a criminal conspiracy to attack the health and liberties of Canadians. And as such, these offenders can and will be tried under this law. They can be arrested and fined tried in common law courts that are being set up by the assemblies, and imprisoned. As anyone engaged in these crimes, they are subject to the law that is being passed today. Public Safety Law Order Number 0908-2020-A, passed by the National Council of Common Law Assemblies. Now, this order, this law, has the full effect and force of the law, and all police across the Canada, all local police, Ontario Provincial Police, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they are all obligated by the law to enforce this lawful order or be charged with obstructing justice. Now, in the wake of passing this law, we've done a few other things today. We've issued a stand-down order to every public official in Canada, to judges, to government officials, to the bureaucrats imposing these laws, to the police, health officers. They're to stand down and not to enforce these COVID regulations, or they will be publicly charged with engaging in a crime against humanity. And finally, the third thing that we need to do, as well as deliver these stand-down orders and post these public laws everywhere you can, on the internet, in your community, everywhere, the third weapon you have is this notice to the people of Canada of what we've done and to the people of the world. It's a notice of public safety law outlawing the COVID measures, and it says you're free to actively resist these measures now, and you can use this every time you go into a restaurant and they try to mask you, every time you go to the doctor and they try to do that, or in the upcoming period when your children are being quarantined and kept from you in school. You can use this notice and say, you people who are doing this are committing a crime. You are personally liable, and I will hold you personally liable for any damages that happen, and we're going to bring you into our common law courts and try you for that. Now, copies of all of these things are being posted today at the website www.republicofcanada, that's K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofcanada.ca. You can also get copies by writing to the Council of Assemblies, plural, Council of Assemblies at protonmail.com, or by writing to republicofcanada@gmail.com. Now, it's up to you, the people, to enforce these regulations. Under our common law republic, all of the people are deputized to defend their rights and to enforce these lawful court orders, these laws that are coming out of the assemblies that represent you, the people. There's no other agency in Canada that's providing the democratic forum for these laws to be passed, so it's essential now that you do that. This is really a declaration of independence from this corporate tyranny being imposed on all Canadians and all people all over the world. We have sounded a bell of freedom all over the world. A shot heard around the world is now echoing even stronger through our national law. Write to us, Council of Assemblies at protonmail.com. Get copies of these orders at republicofcanada.ca. Carry it on, brothers and sisters. There'll be more announcements from the Republic and the Common Law Assemblies very soon. I thank you.
It's a good start in using available legislative tools to send a message that we the people strike down all COVID-19 restrictions. This is in the context of elected leadership using error-prone data to lock down economies. The High Wire News Show, hosted by Del Bigtree, has been reporting on this topic with expert analysis for months, and recently put together a 2-hour compilation of reports from earlier this year. Let's hear part of that.
We have hold on 1 second. So, Jeffrey, what is the breaking news?
Epidemiologist behind highly cited coronavirus model admits he was wrong, drastically revises model. Now, this model informed government policy decisions in the U.S. and the U.K. So Ferguson basically just gave us evidence in the U.K.'s Parliamentary Select Committee on Science and Technology as part of the nation's coronavirus response. So going back to the Daily Wire report, Ferguson's model projected 2.2 million dead in the United States and 500,000 in the United Kingdom if no action was taken. The Daily Wire writes, after just one day of ordered lockdowns in the UK, Ferguson has changed his tune. Now the epidemiologist predicts hospitals will be just fine taking on COVID-19 patients and estimates 20,000. So we have 500,000 goes to 20,000, more than half of whom would have died by the end of the year in any case because they were so old and sick.
One of the lead scientists has been telling us that this dire outcome is now absolutely shifting his tune. 20,000, I am sure it relates to the numbers we are used to in America. That makes this no worse than any other flu, which means, I mean, should we all be jumping up and down? I feel like people should be charging out in the streets and screaming, hooray, it's over, it's over. This thing really was either a hoax or a fraud or one of the biggest mistakes the medical establishment has ever made. Well, that seemed like a huge story when the Imperial model came crashing down. It broke during our show, and I made the statement, and I've been called out in newspapers for saying, there it is, the pandemic is officially over. Well, it was certainly over as it had been described, but it seemed that nobody wanted to stop. In fact, we kept fast-tracking forward as though nothing had happened. It didn't matter that now they were declaring that 20,000 deaths would be the number in England, down from 500,000 deaths, which is only a difference of about 2,000 or so percent. A 2,000% change in the projected numbers did not slow us down at all. And as I had said at the beginning of the discussion about the numbers and the death rate when we're looking at China, if we don't determine what death rate warrants a quarantine, then we are at risk of being in quarantine perpetually, which is what we now see ourselves in. And remember, all the way back then, we weren't even wearing masks yet. All right, on to the next topic that we take a lot of pride in. We were one of the first people to discuss hydroxychloroquine. What's ironic about this story is many of you or many of the people out there in the articles written about me claim that I'm anti-pharma, that I'm anti-vaccine. You know there's a lot more nuance to these conversations, but let's take them at their word. What's ironic about hydroxychloroquine was this was an instance where I was actually promoting a pharmaceutical product called hydroxychloroquine. And then and only then did I actually lose my YouTube channel. So the anti-pharma guy loses his channel when he becomes pro-pharmaceutical product. Weird, but that's the world we live in. How did this story start? It started back in March when we discovered a French virologist, a world-renowned virologist named Dr. Didier Raoult. And this is what he was saying all the way back in the beginning of March. Let's go ahead and talk about a drug. This is really super interesting. Here is a scientist out of France. His name is Didier Raoult. Look at what he said in this video. 500 milligrams of chloroquine per day during 10 days brings a spectacular improvement and is recommended for all clinical cases that tested positive for coronaviruses. He says, actually, from all respiratory infections, it's probably the easiest to treat. There is really no reason to get excited and to rush to produce a vaccine. Now, later near the end of that month in March, Donald Trump, President of the United States, declared that he liked this drug, this anti-malaria drug called hydroxychloroquine. Well, we all watched all of the media descend upon him and attack him. We watched Tony Fauci step away and say, I'm not so sure about hydroxychloroquine. It seems random. There's no studies on it. And there seemed to be this rift in the White House. That issue has become more and more political as it went along. But then in the middle of April, we stumbled upon a study that blew our minds, a study from all the way back in 2005 when the National Institute of Health, where Dr. Tony Fauci was working, they did a study of hydroxychloroquine and the SARS coronavirus. Here is us breaking that story in April. When Didier Raoult said, game over, on February 25th, Anthony Fauci waited till April 9th to start a trial on this product. If you take this scale and you bring it all the way back and back and back and back, continuing back, what we find all the way back here in 2005, the NIH, where Anthony Fauci has worked since the 1980s, funded a hydroxychloroquine study that looked at its use on SARS coronavirus. It says, chloroquine is effective in preventing the spread of SARS-CoV in cell culture. Favorable inhibition of virus spread was observed when the cells were either treated with chloroquine prior to or after SARS-CoV infection. You see, this was known. When Anthony Fauci said we were wondering about the harms of mitigation like locking people down, what if you didn't have to lock down anyone? Had you done studies over the last several years or right at that moment? Let's look back at chloroquine. And to this date, right now, there is no treatment, no chloroquine, no remdesivir, nothing being used as the protocol in the United States of America. And I think that is egregious. I think it's dangerous. And when we look at timing, it's perhaps one of the most shocking stories that we will continue to cover. How long will it take to get to a treatment? Well, as fate would have it, the same week that the frontline doctors were taken off the internet, we lost our YouTube channel 2 days later on a Wednesday, right before our Thursday show. But that doesn't matter because the story continues. And on August 20th, we broke the news through another source. Sky News in Australia was talking about a brilliant discovery in Switzerland. This maybe is some of the best evidence yet at the success of hydroxychloroquine. Take a look at this. Watch this amazing report coming out of Australia just this last week.
The consequences of suddenly stopping hydroxychloroquine can be seen by examining the case fatality ratio index for Switzerland. It can be seen that during the weeks preceding the ban on hydroxychloroquine, the index fluctuated between 3 and 5%. But after stopping outpatient hydroxychloroquine use, the country's COVID-19 deaths increased 4 times to the highest level it had been since the pandemic began, oscillating at over 10 to 15%. Then, when early outpatient hydroxychloroquine was reinstated on June the 11th, the fourfold wave of excess lethality rapidly returned back to where it was.
That's an incredible discovery. Now, I want to point out, we continue to stand behind our reporting on hydroxychloroquine. There's over 78 studies worldwide now showing its effectiveness and also its safety rating. Now, of course, this is a drug that has been safe for 65 years, used, you know, for malaria, but also other off-label usages like lupus. Let's be clear, when the President of the United States, Donald Trump, declared he liked hydroxychloroquine, that was mid-March. In mid-March, when he said that, there was 182 deaths from COVID-19. We are now approaching 200,000 deaths.
That was part of a two-hour compilation from The High Wire with Del Bigtree. Let's now go over a few articles. Here's one from August 5th, 2020 on the Global Research page by David DeGraw. PCR tests are used worldwide to, quote, diagnose SARS-CoV-2 infection. An in-depth investigation reveals clear scientific evidence proving that these tests are not accurate and create a statistically significant percentage of false positives. Positive results more likely indicate, quote, ordinary respiratory disease, such as the common cold. In fact, American biochemist Carrie Mullis, now deceased, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for creating the PCR technology, repeatedly stated throughout his career that it should not be used to test for viruses. This is something we reported on the show in April. This technology is designed to replicate DNA sequences, not test for coronavirus infections. They are reporting, as the evidence reveals, that the number of COVID positive results and the number of COVID-related deaths have been significantly exaggerated. Based on our findings, the World Health Organization, the CDC, and the FDA should not be trusted or relied upon for accurate information and needs to be immediately investigated and held accountable for crimes against humanity. This is in the Global Research article. Fact one, as thousands of doctors worldwide have proven, there are several effective treatments for this coronavirus. Fact two, the effective treatments have been censored and suppressed for reasons including but not limited to, they are inexpensive, big pharma can't profit off of them, they completely derail the wider agenda of those interests who are exploiting this virus to implement the most oppressive economic, health, and surveillance system ever. C, There is FDA emergency use authorization law, which only allows the mass, quote, vaccination program to continue if there are no other effective treatments. There's also the EUA national security stipulation that requires a significant percentage of the population to be at risk of death, which is another reason why fraudulent false positive testing is being used. For all of these reasons, the effective treatments have been suppressed, leading to the unnecessary deaths of thousands of people. Fact three, the handling of this virus has resulted in an all-out economic disaster, destroying the livelihood and financial security of billions of people worldwide, leading to unprecedented rates of debt, depression, drug abuse, overdose, and suicide. Meanwhile, the CARES Act and global central banking operations in response to this crisis have resulted in an unprecedented consolidation of wealth by the world's richest 0.01%. Fact four, the lockdown, quarantine, and closure of schools, religious services, sports, recreational activities, social events, shopping, food, and workplaces, along with social distancing measures and mandatory mask use in combination with criminally negligent 24/7 mainstream media virus fear propaganda amounts to psychological torture and abuse on an unprecedented scale, which has torn apart and separated many families and has done significant damage to the psychological well-being of billions of people, particularly young children worldwide. Fact 5. Underfunded and cash-strapped hospitals have been financially incentivized to record as many COVID-related deaths as possible, resulting in statistically significant number of falsely reported COVID-related deaths. On top of that, hospitals have been heavily incentivized to put people on ventilators, which has also contributed to thousands of additional unnecessary deaths. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.